Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Probiotic is now a selling point for food. Probiotic supplements and foods like yogurt, kimchi, and kombucha all promise to aid in digestion and general health by breeding good gut bacteria. A Cambridge, Massachusetts startup is among a flood of enterprises looking at the effects of bacteria outside the body. AO Biome is testing a body spray, which it says can restore healthy, deodorizing, immune-boosting, anti-inflammatory bacteria to the skin and hair. Exactly the microscopic stuff we regularly wash away with soap and shampoo. Journalist and radio producer Julia Scott played guinea pig, going for a month without bathing, to test AO Biome's refreshing cosmetic mist. She wrote about the experience for the New York Times Magazine. Julia Scott, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So tell us more about this refreshing cosmetic mist product. What is it, and what does AO Biome theorize that it can do?
So the product is called AO Plus, which stands for ammonia oxidizing. The ammonia oxidizing bacteria in this spray is called Nitrosomonas eutropha, which is kind of a mouthful. And it's bacteria, live bacteria, that the company is hoping to sell people like me and you to spray on our skin every day after we bathe. And it is their contention that this spray will make your skin feel more hydrated and healthier, and possibly in the long run cause you to have less of a need for cleaning products and maybe even deodorant as well.
So you said after we bathe, that means that you went to the extremes. AO Plus would be used sort of like we use deodorant now.
Conceivably. It depends on people's own body odor needs, I guess. But yes, I did go to the extreme for my story. What I decided to do to test out their product was to give myself the challenge of becoming a study subject for them for 28 days, try out their product, but remove all the conceivable variables, because the company had warned me that their body spray contained bacteria that, in spite of, you know, being 20 million bacteria for each spritz, are very sensitive to modern cleaning products and shampoos. I decided, well, I wasn't going to take any chances, and spent the entire 28-day study period without washing myself with soaps, shampoos. I also gave up deodorants, moisturizers, face cleansers, everything in my cabinet, basically.
So you misted yourself twice a day, and you were swabbed each week to detect changes. Did anyone notice or comment on your unwashed self or appearance?
You know, I will tell you that if you want to know who your real friends are, be sure to ask them to smell you after 28 days of not bathing with soap or shampoo and tell you what they think. So I have some very good friends. Some of them were even brave enough to get their nose right in there under my arms and give me lengthy descriptions of what I smelled like. Others said I smelled great, but they were usually on the other side of the room when they said it.
Here are some reactions that you managed to get on tape.
Julia smelled like scalp. Her hair looked like she had lathered it with butter.
I never saw any proof that she's actually writing this article, so I wonder if she just got really lazy for a month.
I'm really curious about the friend who pushed the nose right into the armpit. What was the reaction there?
You know, I got everything from, "You smell like my Dutch grandmother," to, "You smell like a homeless person," which is not what you want to hear, to, "You smell like onions," which I myself had detected, to, "You smell like pleasant pot," which was interesting. I don't know how I came to smell like pungent marijuana, but apparently that's part of my amino acid complex. So, you know, that was interesting.
It doesn't sound like it works then.
Well, here's the thing. You know, first of all, it's I can't say whether it works or doesn't. I do know that the function of these bacteria are to oxidize ammonia in your sweat. and turn them into scent-free harmless byproducts, nitrite and nitric oxide. So they kind of kidnap the smelling process, but they need sweat in order to do it. And the only time I really sweated was when I went to the gym. And let me tell you, I avoided going to the gym for much of the experiment for just that reason. I was afraid it was going to happen. But it was the one time in the experiment that after I sprayed myself with the bacteria before and after, my smell was gone.
This kind of reminds me of, do you remember like 10 years ago, there was this unshampoo movement? You know, people said you shouldn't shampoo your hair, you should just condition it or whatever. And there was this argument that we've trained our bodies to need washing. I wonder what you observed. Was your hair less greasy? Was your skin greasy? Did you have breakouts? Just curious.
You know, what's interesting, first of all, is that the no poo movement, no shampoo, actually still exists. I discovered it online in the course of my research, and it seems to have more adherence than ever. People who say that shampoo is, you know, is hurting us, and so are modern cleansers, and so they go without in many cases. You know, I observed that my skin actually, although my hair became very greasy and disgusting, my skin ended up feeling surprisingly hydrated. It was sort of like I had started visiting the sauna every week. And I also observed that my hormonally related breakouts disappeared, which was very unexpected because I had spent my teenage years taking antibiotics to clear up my skin to no avail. And all of a sudden here I was spraying probiotics, which might have had a more positive result all along.
Julia Scott is with us. She's a writer and radio producer who tried out a new live bacteria body spray, which is basically a probiotic for your skin, and wrote about the experience for the New York Times Magazine. Do you think something like the AO Biome spray could catch on?
I have a sense that it will, and I'll tell you why. The question are we too clean? Speaks to the fact that, you know, I think we're starting to recast our relationship with bacteria. If you think about it, we've never had a more schizophrenic relationship with bacteria than we do now. You know, we're eating probiotics every day at the same time as we're slathering on antibacterial soap and lotions. So we don't really want to think about the bacteria living on us, but we kind of want the bacteria that are good, but we're not sure which ones those are. And so I think we're starting to finally take a more nuanced view that while some bacteria are harmful, most are not. And that is what my research has borne out. And in fact, most bacteria has evolved to help us in ways that we don't yet understand. Now, that said, you'd think that a live probiotic body spray that looks and smells and tastes like water would not be an easy sell. But in fact, to my understanding, AO Biome has received more than 7,000 orders since my article came out.
Well, your article really did stir up quite a storm, but I've noticed that it's being cast as kind of a, should we wash or not wash? I mean, that seems to be where the argument is coming down. And I'm wondering how public health officials, you know, people who want signs everywhere that say, wash your hands after using the bathroom, how have they reacted to your article?
I haven't really seen too much of a reaction from public health officials, but I'll take this opportunity to say that hygiene is essential. And I did wash my hands during the experiment. There was no question that I wasn't going to, you know, stay healthy. And, you know, I don't think probiotics have come to the point yet where, you know, we're going to be spraying our hands with bacteria before we go into the surgical chamber in hospitals instead of using antibacterials. But I do think that the reason that we're talking about, you know, smell and cleanliness is that the entire role of soap has changed. It used to be for medical purposes, and now we've been persuaded that we need all kinds of products, not just to, you know, wipe away basic grime from our hands, but to be good smelling, to mask our personal odors at the same time as they wash our oils away. You know, my grandmother, you know, when she was growing up, never showered every day the way I grew up showering every day. She showered once a week and she washed her hair once a week. And, you know, she's just no smellier than I am. So I think culture has played a role in persuading us about the fact that we're smelly and unclean when we might just smell like ourselves.
The chemist who created AO Plus Cosmetic Mist had not showered for 12 years. I'm wondering if you are considering making the leap into the non-shampooing, non-soaping, just misting.
No. Short answer is no. You know, if there's one thing this experiment taught me is that I desperately need shampoo in my hair. However, I will say that I did change my habits radically after I stopped using AO Plus. I now only use shampoo twice a week instead of every day. I've stopped using deodorant with odor in it. I use fragrance-free deodorant. And I don't use any cleansers on my face at all. You know, I used to have like 3 or 4 different washes for my face and my body. So I ended up throwing out, you know, 75% of the cleaning products I was using. And I did it because I wanted to challenge myself to try to create as hospitable a personal biome as I could for my microflora, because I sort of got to know my own universe of bacteria up close during this experiment. And in the end, I think the biggest transformation was psychological, because I couldn't bear the thought of harming them more than I needed to.
Julia Scott, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My huge pleasure.
Julia Scott is a writer and a radio producer. You can find a link to her article for the New York Times Magazine and read more about AO Biome at wordofmouthradio.org. If you're looking for something novel to do this weekend, look no further. When Word of Mouth continues, a sneak peek of the bands and performers hitting the stage at A Thing in the Spring in Peterborough. That's after the break. Word of Mouth! This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Looking for something truly novel to do this weekend? The Thing in the Spring returns to the Monadnock region, growing bigger and more varied each year. Last week, we heard musician David Contact playing with a band of slinkies, building materials, and making music out of found objects. He'll be performing. We asked Thing in the Spring founder, now creative director Eric Gagnon, what else is going on?
Well, we've got a ton of stuff. I think about 40 or so bands playing over 4 days. Of course, we have the Broke the Affordable Arts Fair happening on Saturday the 7th. And we'll also have behind that in the field, there will be a big tent and a concert happening all day. We'll have outdoor vendors, we'll have food vendors, and a beer tent from Sam Adams.
Oh, wow. So who's coming here for music acts?
So Thursday, Magic Markers is headlining, and they're fantastic. They were on mostly from Western Mass and New York, but really far out, but with kind of like a deep indie rock kind of sensibility.
Let's hear a little bit from Magic Markers.
On Friday, we have Lady Lamb, the beekeeper.
Oh, we love her. Yeah. She played in Studio D for us.
Yeah. So she's going to be here. Every night after each of the main shows, there are a couple bands at Harlow's for after, and then there's also going to be a DJ at the Waterhouse. And actually, Friday and Saturday, we're having a couple of films, too. Criterion Collection was really awesome and gave us a couple of movies to show.
What are you showing?
Well, since it's the seventh thing in the spring, Friday night we'll be showing The Seventh Seal, and Saturday we'll be showing Seven Samurai. And then at The Late Show on Friday night is going to be Ruff Francis. They're just unreal. Probably one of the best rock and roll bands that's playing. Like, it sounds almost like a mix between like the Stooges and maybe even like a little Rolling Stones and Minutemen, just real hard-hitting, like good-feeling rock and roll.
Let's hear a little bit from Ruff Francis. This band is going to be playing The Late Show at Harlow's, because there's always something to do even after the day for The Thing in the Spring. Do you love me? Or do you hate my guts?
Saturday. There's going to be a ton of bands from all over New England and New York, and headlining that one is MV and EE.
Mm-hmm.
Really great duo from Brattleboro. Uh-huh. A real nice psychedelic treat for the late afternoon. The Saturday night show, Simon Felice is headlining from the Felice Brothers, and he's played in the Lumineers and Mumford and Sons. I think he toured with them, a bunch of other people, and he's going to be playing with Death Vessel and Mail the Horse, who are really good.
So David Kontak, who we had in the studio last week, he's playing Saturday night, I believe?
He's playing Sunday.
Sunday,
yep,
okay.
Sunday we've got Charlie Hunter and Bobby Previtt.
Charlie Hunter, perfect fit for David Kontak. He's designed his own guitar with 8 strings, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yep. And Nat Baldwin is playing that show, too, from the Dirty Projectors.
Well, Eric, it sounds like it's just getting bigger and better and more varied. Congratulations to you, and thanks for coming by.
Thanks a lot, Virginia.
Eric Gagne, who's founder and creative director of Thing in the Spring, along with a whole bunch of other folks in the Monadnock region who put this together. Broke Art Fair, music galore, as you hear, and this year adding a couple of great films from the Criterion Collection. It takes place from June 5th through the 8th in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and you can see a lot more, including a schedule at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, in case you missed the David Kontak Ensemble's performance live in Studio D, here's a little snippet of the band performing Slinky Quartet on, you guessed it, Slinkies. Kontak's experimental soundscapes call to mind sweeping cinematic scenes and practically yearn to score something dramatic. Fortunately, we have the perfect narrative in mind. Short story writer David Chevalier recently earned a top 3 spot in the New Hampshire Writers Project's statewide flash fiction competition for his story, Not Usual.
Karen found herself looking over the smooth mahogany casket once again. Most everyone had left by that point. But she saw that Jill, the being of pure energy from accounting, had remained behind. It was difficult to tell from the vaguely humanoid form that beings of pure energy generally assumed around humans whether she was upset or not, but Karen was worried that her feelings had been hurt. Just then, perhaps sensing that Karen was thinking about her, entirely possible for a being of pure energy, Jill's bluish form glided eerily over. "Thank you," Karen said, laying a hand on the casket and trying her best to sound grateful. "And thank you for coming."
"You are most welcome. I'm happy to have been invited to your ritual. Please, can you confirm, was my offering acceptable to you?"
"Acceptable?" Karen looked down the long table at the other gifts. Small, brightly colored toys, large print books covered in drawings of cartoon animals, and piles of tiny clothes. "It's lovely." She hesitated. "It's just that it isn't usual to give a casket at a baby shower." There was no reply. After an awkward silence, Karen gradually became aware of a low hum, quiet at first, then increasing in volume. Soon a second tone emerged, and then a third, forming a minor chord. There was a pulsing quality to the sound, and Karen suddenly became aware that Jill's shimmering form was pulsing at the same frequency. "Oh my, are you crying?" The hum increased in volume.
"Oh, Karen, I've ruined your celebration, haven't I? I was afraid I had. I read that every human needs one of these, and I wanted to get you one for your offspring before someone else had."
"No, I only said it wasn't usual. I like it very much. Please stop crying." The hum faded, but didn't stop.
"It's just that I value our friendship so much, Karen. It's never been easy for me to make friends. I've always been awkward, even among my own kind."
"Please, you're being silly. I'm glad to have you as a friend, too." The hum faded to silence.
"Then you like it?"
"Yes, and I will have need for it, just not for a very long time, I hope. In the meantime, I can use it as a changing station." They laughed, and Karen felt the tension disappearing.
"Still friends?"
Jill asked. "Yes, of course. I do have quite a lot to sort through, though, so I guess I'll see you on Monday."
"Yes, I'm so happy for you. And I simply can't wait to witness the expulsion."
It took Karen several seconds to realize that Jill had just invited herself into the delivery room. She forced a smile as Jill's bluish form turned and glided out of the room. Won't that be nice, she said.
David Chevalier there reading his award-winning story, Not Usual. Director Bong Joon-ho's sci-fi epic Snowpiercer stars two Academy Award-winning actors in maybe the most highly anticipated film you've never heard of. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll find out why it's unlikely to come to a theater near you. That's after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From The Hunger Games to the Divergent trilogy, Hollywood loves the dystopian future. But there is one star-studded sci-fi thriller opening this month that you probably haven't heard anything about, Snowpiercer. It's a South Korean film, but stars a mostly English-speaking cast that includes Chris Evans, Tilda Swinton, Ed Harris, and John Hurt. To date, the film has been released everywhere but the U.S. It hit select theaters here in June. And joining us now to explain, A, why we're just hearing about it now, and B, whether the movie is actually any good, is Ty Burr, Boston Globe film critic and author of Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. Ty, great to have you back.
Thanks, Virginia. Great to be here.
So before we hear about the backstory, maybe a brief summary of what Snowpiercer is about.
Snowpiercer, which I have seen, is quite a remarkable movie. It takes place in a fantastic future in which humanity has destroyed the environment by trying to control global warming, which has just frozen the planet instead. And the remnants of humanity have taken refuge on a train. It's like an ark, except it moves, that circumnavigates the globe once a year. It's this incredibly long, high-tech train with the poor people in the back and the rich people up front. So you have this microcosm of society going on in it. The director is Bong Joon-ho, a Korean filmmaker who's best known to art house audiences for movies like Memories of Murder, Mother, and this absolutely wonderful tongue-in-cheek Godzilla movie called The Host, about a monster that terrorizes Seoul.
So let's hear just a little bit from the trailer from Snowpiercer.
All things in their place. All passengers in their section. We must each of us occupy our preordained particular position. I belong to the front. You belong to the tail. Know your place. Keep your place.
I guess I would do it if the villainous Tilda Swinton was yelling at me.
Yes, a very fearsome Tilda Swinton in all her Tilda Swintonness.
So what's the backstory here, Ty? Why is such a big global film making it so late to American theaters?
Well, the two-word answer to that is Harvey Weinstein. Hmm. The fearsome Harvey Weinstein of Weinstein Pictures, formerly,
Miramax.
The man who created Miramax, who is known in the industry not flatteringly as Harvey Scissorhands, in that he often will buy up a film for distribution and then demand cuts. And he's, famed for doing that to movies like Sling Blade, The Hours, Frida, Princess Mononoke. He is known for wanting to cut films. And the story with Snowpiercer is that he bought distribution rights for the U.S. and other territories quite a while back on the basis of a script and some scenes that had been filmed. And then Bong Joon-ho turned in a cut just over 2 hours that's very dark, very creative. It's an incredibly stylized movie, very propulsive. And he demanded 20 minutes of cuts before he would release it in the United States. He didn't say, but he was paraphrased by other people as saying he wanted to make it appealing to people in the middle of the country, to, Iowa and Idaho and Oklahoma. He wanted to make sure that the film would be understood. Now, of course, that immediately got a backlash from, Bong Joon-ho, the director, his cast, and a lot of film lovers saying, You know, this is this guy's vision. Why should you mess with it? Bong Joon-ho, the director, refused to make the cuts. There were negotiations that broke down. And then in February, Weinstein announced that, yes, we will be distributing Snowpiercer uncut, but we're not going to give it a wide release. We're just going to give it a limited release, which means open it in New York and L.A., see how the reviews do, and then maybe it will get to your big city and forget about the multiplexes across the land.
Hmm. And this is after getting really good reviews around the globe, of course, not from Peoria, but from several newspapers around the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not a perfect film, but it's very well done. It's got rave reviews from Variety, and it's also opened in Korea and other parts of the globe. It was a box office runaway hit in Korea and has done very, very well in other countries as well. I mean, it is a very singular vision. The analogy might be to a movie like Blade Runner, which also ran into problems where the head office decided they needed to make it more friendly to audiences.
Was this movie made with English-speaking audiences in mind? I mean, why make a South Korean film where the cast speaks English?
Well, I mean, Bong Joon-ho has built a global profile over the course of his career, over the past decade or so. And the fact that this movie stars Captain America, Chris Evans, in a very, very dark role. I almost didn't recognize him for the first half of the movie. He looks quite different. He's a very rough, tough anti-hero, and the movie is quite violent in ways that are very stylish, and that is factored into, for some people, into Weinstein's thinking that, you know, he has gotten flack before for some of the violence of his Tarantino films and other films that he's distributed, and that maybe he felt it was too violent, but I don't think that that's actually the case. I think he wanted to just trim out the character parts and make it more of an action movie, but you do have Chris Evans, you do have Tilda Swinton, you have John Hurt, you have Octavia Spencer, who won an Oscar for The Help. You have Ed Harris. You know, it's definitely aimed at a global audience, and it's all in English. So, yeah, anybody can watch this movie and, you know, get where it's coming from.
Well, you said not a perfect movie. You have a grade for it, Ty?
Oh, on my Boston Globe star rating, I'd probably give it 3.5 out of 4. But even I think its flaws are aspects of Bong Joon-ho's vision. The problem I have with Harvey Weinstein wanting to cut this movie is, you know, I can understand if it's a genre piece made by a hack director, but Bong Joon-ho is not that. He is a singular visionary filmmaker. He is an artist for better and for worse. And there are aspects of the movie that I don't think entirely work, but it's unlike anything else I've seen out there. And I think you have to take his vision 100% or not at all.
So what I'm hearing here, Ty, is there's a potential for a groundswell among viewers to make this a much more popular movie, and maybe it will make it to wider release. Has there been any precedent for that?
I don't know that there's been a precedent for what's going on in this particular case, and I think social media and Twitter and the movie lovers' blogs has a lot to do with that. It put Harvey Weinstein under the spotlight. Now, granted, the film isn't getting the wide release that it might otherwise have gotten, but it is going to be on video on demand. People will have heard about this movie. They'll have a chance to see it. Arguably, they won't be able to see it in a movie theater where it really does, you know, kick. But it kind of goes to the question of, you know, who owns a movie? The person who makes it? The person who has the rights to put it in theaters? Or the people who watch it? And I would argue that in this case, the people who stand to watch it and the person who made it won.
Ty Burr, thanks so much for your read on Snowpiercer.
Thank you.
Ty Burr, Boston Globe film critic and author of Gods Like Us on movie stardom and modern fame. You can find a link to hear our interview with Ty on that very book and see the trailer and reviews for Snowpiercer at wordofmouthradio.org. Between Netflix, Redbox, Amazon, Hulu, and every other on-demand service, access to films and television has never been easier. But despite our unprecedented access to thousands of titles, new and old, In fact, maybe because of it, choosing what to watch has never been harder. With hundreds of selections being added and removed from each service each month, sifting through the choices can be a Herculean task. Fear not, joining me to offer his picks for movies worth watching this month is producer Taylor Quimby. Taylor, hi. Thanks for coming all this way.
It was a rough commute.
So there are more ways to watch movies and television series than ever before. What are you looking at?
Well, I wanted to narrow down some of the subscription-based services that people probably already pay on a monthly basis, or say something like Redbox, where you're only paying, you know, $2 per rental or something like that. Because, you know, these days you really can watch almost any movie right after it's left the movie theater, sometimes while it's still at the movie theater, through on-demand services that will charge you much more, $8, $9, $10 sometimes for, say, an HD version of a film. So you can watch virtually everything right away. But for people who want to keep to a budget, want to use those subscription services that they pay for, I'm trying to look at things like Redbox, Netflix, maybe Amazon Prime down the road. But they're a little harder to judge what's coming up in the next month.
Although people anticipate the next television series. You know, right now, Mad Men is halfway through its season. It's not going to pick up for a while. Game of Thrones is almost over. What should we be looking out for television?
Well, for television right now, the big thing that's just about to drop, actually, I should say, has already dropped this morning, is the Netflix original show Orange is the New Black. Season 2 has just been made available today, and I know a lot of people are going to be binge-watching the entire thing all night long.
I am prepared to behave like a model inmate, and I feel I no longer pose a threat.
Like, what have you done with the place?
Sadly, it's starting to feel like home in here.
3, 2, 1, go!
Okay, so our binge-watching television needs are taken care of. What about movies, though, Taylor? Every time I go to Netflix, there are so many to choose from. And, of course, they choose some for me, which I don't know who they think I am, but they're not always quite on. So any recommendations for stuff that's coming out that's worth watching?
You know, a lot of the movies that they add are sort of old classics, movies that you frankly could see flipping through the channels. You might land on it, you know, any given day on the week. And this month is no different. There's a lot of titles that are good, but you've probably seen them before. Apocalypse Now, the Redux version. Carrie, the 76 original adaptation of the Stephen King novel. Clear and Present Danger with Harrison Ford, or the Civil War drama Cold Mountain. All of those have been made available just in the past couple days on Netflix. But for newer movies, there's definitely fewer options, and they're spaced out a little further apart. This month, the big Netflix offering is World War Z, the Brad Pitt zombie flick.
Oh, yeah, the zombie one from last summer, even?
Yep.
The noise. Are they drawn to it?
Yeah. Sam draws them.
You fought any yet?
Philly, Newark.
Good.
What about Houston, Lewis?
Baltimore.
Atlanta.
Detroit.
Guys, I'll be honest with you. I don't know of any place back home that's doing very well.
And that's out on the 13th. And then a few days later, you can catch Old Boy. Now, this is Spike Lee's remake of the South Korean horror film. It's not for squeamish viewers. I don't think it lived up to the original, but fans of that original film will definitely want to weigh in. Big movie that I'd like to recommend is the 2003 animated feature, The Triplets of Belleville.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was a great movie. It's a French film. It's about a trio of sisters. They help...
Pretty much wordless.
Yeah, there's some music. Great music, actually. Very charming. A good family-friendly flick for the month.
Singing Belleville Rendezvous. My don't dancing, dippy-doo.
That's on Netflix specifically.
Yep, Netflix instant streaming. There's, of course, more options through the DVD service.
So how about on Redbox, the thing that you go to your supermarket or wherever, big box store, and you see this Redbox out front? I've never used one, actually. I've seen people at them, but you get them one DVD at a time?
Well, you can get as many as you want. Redbox offers a variety of video games and movies, and there's different selections at every one because you can pick up a Redbox at one kiosk and return it to another. So because of that, they don't all have the same movies. For that reason, I actually recommend going online, and you can see what they have through their website before you drive down to sort of just browse through the options. And you can even reserve using a credit card or whatnot. You can reserve which film you want to use so that nobody can snag it before you've gotten down to your kiosk. Redbox, like Netflix, there is a lot of crap. When I go to Redbox, I'm always reminded how many bad straight-to-DVD movies are being created that you never hear about. And this month, I laughed because some of my favorite worst editions were kids' movies like Abner, the Invisible Dog, Dude, Where's My Dog? And this is my favorite. It's got John Voight in it, of all people. Baby Geniuses and the Treasure of Egypt. So those are what you probably don't want to see. But there are a couple really good ones coming. June 10th, the Best Picture nominee from last year, Her. It was written and directed by Spike Jones. Yep, stars Joaquin Phoenix, his mustache, and Scarlett Johansson's voice.
Please wait as your operating system is initiated.
Hello, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Samantha.
Good morning, Theodore.
Good morning.
You have a meeting in 5 minutes. You want to try getting out of bed?
You're too funny.
Okay, good, I'm funny. I want to learn everything about everything.
I love the way you look at the world.
And then I guess my wild card for this month is a British movie called How I Live Now, which was directed by the guy who did The Last King of Scotland, Kevin MacDonald, and stars the young Irish actress Saoirse Ronan. She was in Hannah, the Grand Budapest Hotel. She was in The Lovely Bones and a few other movies.
Yeah, she was also in Atonement.
Atonement, yeah. And that looks kind of like a less sensational take on the apocalyptic trend. It's sort of like a love story that's taking place at the same time that World War III is kicking off. And then June 17th, the movie Joe, which I don't know too much about it, but I know it's worth seeing because according to critics, Nicolas Cage has a great performance, which, you know, only happens like every 4 years, the sun and Venus are in some sort of alignment or something like that. And Nicolas Cage like breaks out of the terrible, terrible roles that he generally takes on and does a great movie.
Hey, mister.
Yeah?
Me and my daddy just got into town. I was wondering if you'd give us a job.
I pay a day's pay for a day's work. And if we work till dinner and get rained out, I pay for the whole day. Does that sound fair enough?
Yes, sir.
I'm Joe. And I watched that boy. I see someone who's nothing like me.
What are you looking at?
So before we wrap, you, Taylor Quimby, our resident movie expert, are going to ask listeners a question, an informal movie-related kind of poll, if you will, and you're going to bring us the results next month. Do you have a question today?
I do. This is one I've been thinking about for a while, and it's something that makes a lot of sense given that we're talking about the streaming services. I've got my own answer, but I want to hear what people have to say. So here's the question. If, for the rest of your life, you could only watch movies or television programs, one or the other, which would you choose and why?
Okay, we're throwing it out there, Taylor Quimby, with some alternatives to the summer blockbuster. Thank you so much.
Of course.
You find a list of Taylor's on-demand top recommendations for Redbox and Netflix Instant this month and a link to his Tumblr, Abbreviated Movie Reviews, all at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you'd like to contribute to our informal poll, the conversation has already started on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. You can also leave your suggestions on our listener line at 603-223-2448. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're a fan of HBO's hit fantasy series Game of Thrones, you know that the world where it takes place is just as large and varied as the planet we live on today. There are continents, oceans, vast deserts, frozen wastelands, lush valleys, tropics, you name it. And as Michael Osborne of the podcast Generation Anthropocene discovered, digging into the fictional geology and geography of Game of Thrones turns out to be a surprisingly insightful exercise.
Imagining Earth millions of years ago is almost like reading a book set in a fantasy world. Our planet was once covered in ice, and before that, swamped by oceans. We envisioned supercontinents, supervolcanoes, and gargantuan creatures. We use scientific observations to reconstruct the geologic past, but if you think about it, our investigation into Earth history isn't that different from the work of science fiction. So when our producer, Miles Traer, who's also a geophysicist, decided that he wanted to apply his geology skills to Game of Thrones, there was a certain logic to his thought exercise.
So I took the main continent of the story, which is Westeros,
And I decided to use little bits of information from the books, from, you know, the observations of the characters, from official maps, and a few other details to create a geologic map.
Okay, so the idea is sort of ridiculous, but Miles' map is surprisingly detailed and scientific. Fans of the HBO TV show are familiar with the Game of Thrones landscape from the show's opening credits. And, like a lot of fantasy stories, the Game of Thrones books contain maps of the imaginary world. The inspiration for Miles' project began when he noticed that the two continents in the story, Westeros and Essos, fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. It reminded him of the way Africa and North and South America fit together, suggesting continental drift and the presence of plate tectonics. Miles then started scouring the books for additional clues. He studied the orientation of mountain ranges. He tested different map projections to calculate the distances and dimensions of the Game of Thrones world. He discovered a website called Westeros,
the Wiki of Ice and Fire,
whose authors had already tried to work out the size of the planet. Miles extrapolated information from town names and made note every time a character mentioned the rocks used to construct castles.
We know there's granite in Winterfell. We also know that there are hot springs there, so that plays into this idea of tectonics. We know there's this area called the Flint Cliffs, and I assume to interpret that literally, which I do with quite a few cities. You have Casterly Rock, where there are gold deposits. Gold is usually deposited within very specific rocks, basalts. There's a town. There are multiple towns in the south in this area known as Dorne, south of the Red Mountains. And there are three towns in particular, one of them called Sandstone. There was another one called the Salt Shore. And then there was another place called Greenstone.
Once he had a draft map of the current Game of Thrones world, the next phase was to reconstruct the geologic history. Game of Thrones is the same story, of course, where characters often remark that
winter is coming.
And the ice wall of the north is what helps protect all characters from the dreaded White Walkers. Perhaps, thought Miles, extensive glaciation played a role in shaping the Game of Thrones geomorphology. Paleoclimate turned out to be an important consideration.
There's this region called the Mountains of the Moon, and Mountains of the Moon sit in between King's Landing and the Twins. And in the Mountains of the Moon, there's this curious gap in the middle of the mountains. It looks like it's been eroded flat. And really, the only thing that has that much power are ice sheets. Now, for an ice sheet to extend that far south, the planet would need to be generally colder. And that was something that I really wanted to consider, is that, yes, climate can change on this planet, too.
An impressive feature of Miles' analysis is the rigorous way in which he draws from Earth science principles. Beyond tectonics and paleoclimate, he invoked uniformitarianism, the law of superposition, paleontology, subduction zones, continental collisions, and even the formation of an oxygen-rich atmosphere. It's surprising how much trying to reconstruct the natural history of a fantasy world tells us just how much we've come to understand our own planet's history. For a geologist, a map is a hypothesis, an educated guess based on the best available information. Miles hopes that his maps will inspire others to comment and to iterate.
If you can propose a completely different formation of Westeros, I would love to hear it. I would love to know what you think. The only thing that I ask is, you know, document your principles. You know, tell me what you're assuming the way that I have, and I would love to see it. And certainly, this is, it's an interpretation.
The sketches of his geologic reconstruction, along with descriptions, are now live on the Generation Anthropocene website. HBO is currently airing Game of Thrones Season 4. As the Lannisters, Baratheons, Tyrells, Wildlings, and Khaleesi wrestle for control of the crown, maybe viewers will have the chance to glean additional clues into the world of Westeros and Essos. For Generation Anthropocene, I'm Mike Osborne.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is much more at Word of Mouth Radio to hear again and to share. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is how so many people pass on information and share what's going on in their lives today. Our goal is to pass on just a sliver of that. We'll be back with more tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Thank you.